This is Leo Bustad talking about adversity with some associates, which will be announced later. This is for the purpose of the tape person. Last night we had a lot of fun, at least I did. And tomorrow night we'll also have fun. Tonight's a heavy. It's hard to be humorous about adversity sometimes. It is our intention tonight to show you how we have faced adversity, and you will probably help us face it better. But we also hope that we can help some of you who have had difficulty facing adversity. Adversity can cause death. It can cause severe illness and bitterness, or it can result in strengthening us for greater service. I guess you take your choice. I refer to some scripture texts to begin tonight. From Job. After this, Job opened his mouth and cursed the day of his birth. And Job said, "For my sighing comes as my bread, and my groanings are poured out like water. For the thing that I fear comes upon me, and what I dread befalls me. I am not at ease, nor am I quiet. I have no rest, but trouble comes." And from Psalms. My God, why hast thou forsaken me? Why art thou so far from helping me, from the words of my groaning? O my God, I cry by day, but thou dost not answer, and by night, but find no rest. And then this from 2 Corinthians. Seeing then that we have been entrusted with this commission, which we owe entirely to God's mercy, we never lose heart. Following the space shuttle disaster of last January, a six-year-old child said to his grandfather, "They have to come back because the teacher had a girl who was just six like me. What I ask should I say to this little six-year-old and the grandfather?" Last February, in our Delta Society office, Linda Hines and I received a letter from Irene Burnside, who was a dear friend and a consultant to our Delta Society, an internationally respected nurse and author. The letter read in part, "I've fallen in a black hole, bladder cancer, hemorrhage, and then diagnosis of leukemia and skin cancer. Remove my name as I'm not much good to you at this point. I've withdrawn from school." She was working on her PhD at the University of Texas. Her husband died over a decade ago from Lou Gehrig's disease, amyotrophic lateralsclerosis. "What I ask should I say to Irene when I finally reached her by phone?" 2 weeks ago, after finishing a real high of my life at the International Symposium on the Living Bond, People, Animals, Environment in Boston, we're wrapping things up on Monday morning. I'd already made arrangements to see a dear friend of my graduate school days at the University of Washington School of Medicine. His name's Noah Mack. Been a dear friend ever since those times. Your best friends are usually those you have passed through adversity with in graduate school at the University of Washington. Physiology and biophysics program is adversity. And we maintain contact. He's an authority on nuclear war, prevention of nuclear war, what's going to happen in World War III, anti-ballistic missile systems, and such as that. He worked at MIT and Harvard. And he knew I was coming, and he said, "Well, we'll get together on Monday." He says, "It's very important I see you." And so I finished up fairly early on Monday morning. I called Noel up. And he says, "Well," I said, "why don't you come on down, we'll have lunch together." And then he had offered to take me to the airport. And we talked a bit, and then he said, I guess I should give you the latest on Newell Mack. He's 52 years old. He says, I have metastasizing carcinoma of the prostate, and I have only a few months to live. What shall I tell, or what should I have told Newell Mack? Last June 26th, I received a very distressing call. One of my closest friends, and like a brother to me and a professional associate, had been killed. He was 41. Headlines on the Oregonian newspaper 2 days running graphically described the gruesome story, which I mentioned to some of you last night. The first day's headlines was, "Ex-patient kills psychiatrist. Secretary watches in horror as shotgun blast hits doctor." The second day's headlines, "Psychiatrist knew he had a client who might kill." My friend Mike was a pioneer on the international movement regarding people-animal interactions. He was vice president of the Delta Society, which I am president. We were deeply involved in putting this international society together. He left a wife and 5 children, aging parents who depended on him. His youngest child was 2 years old. Many people attended the funeral. The questions asked most was why. What I asked, should I have told Mike's widow, the dependents, Mike's brother, his mother and father who are grieving and will grieve most of all? Over 3 years ago, 3 years and a short 2 months, I received another call, the most tragic of my life. It came from Cameroon, West Africa. It informed me that our daughter Karen, who had spent 2 years as a volunteer for the World Brotherhood Exchange, would not be coming home as planned. Another homecoming had intervened. She's buried on a hillside in a mission station in northern Cameroon, West Africa. A year before Karen died, another girl, a Chicana, for whom I was the nearest thing she had for a father, died from cancer at 33. She was one of 10 children. Her mother was illiterate. She never knew her real father. She took her master's degree with us at the University of California, and we employed her at our laboratory and helped her gain entrance into medical school. She was the first in her family to obtain a professional degree. But like our Karn, she left us before the shadows of her life touched noon. What I ask, should I have said to her mother when she asked why? What should I have told her brothers and her sisters? It seems my life and my wife's life have been marked by a series of great adversities, more for my wife than I. My wife had grade 3 carcinoma. She's lost her hearing. In World War II, we were separated for 32 months. I was washed overboard in a ship in a severe storm without an operable life belt. I spent time in prison camp. I learned what it was to be really hungry, to be really cold, to see people die around me. I was not only a witness to great destruction and death, I was a party to it. That is what I was paid to do, to kill and to destroy. My wife, shortly after receiving the dreaded telegram, "The Department of the Army regrets to inform you that your husband is missing in action," was told by a friend who had just returned to the U.S. from Italy that I was killed at Anzio. Many other terrible things have happened to us, and many more will occur in the future. For to live is to suffer. Yeah, now, in self-pity, we too often assume that none of us has had it as rough as we have. But I'm wise enough to know that many of you have had it worse. One day I asked my wife, the chief, if she ever asked herself, why me? And she said, well, I used to do that, but I've quit. She now asks herself, why not me? Take the story of Job. In rapid succession, The Chaldeans drove off his camels. Sabaean stole his oxen. Lightning killed his sheep. A whirlwind killed his sons. And he contracted the horrible disease. Or take God's chosen people who were really taken through the bite throughout history. They'd lost everything they had when they'd been taken from their homeland to the Babylonian exile. And they'd been there for a long time. In fact, some knew nothing else save exile. Their homes had been destroyed, their temples were demolished, and their priesthood had been non-functional. They'd suffered great adversity. Many more were in deep despair. In fact, matters were so bad, even the young had lost hope. Isaiah, who had been called to minister to them, said, "Even youths shall faint and be weary, and young men shall fall exhausted. Or take the most famous apostle of all, Paul of Tarsus. By our standards, life had been very cruel to him. He encountered adversity heaped upon adversity. In addition to a permanent physical handicap, he had served many prison sentences, faced death again and again, been beaten with a regulation 39 stripes by the Jews 5 times, been beaten with rods 3 times, stoned once, been shipwrecked 3 times, and on the open sea for 24 hours. I was only out for an hour. And I thought that was bad enough. Been in constant danger from river and floods, from bandits, from his own countrymen, from pagans. He knew exhaustion, pain, long vigils, hunger, thirst, doing without meals, cold, and lack of clothing. He learned that to live was to suffer. It is very important that each one here tonight come to the realization that life is difficult. These are the first words in the recent bestseller entitled The Road Less Traveled. Its author is a psychiatrist named Dr. Scott Peck. He went on to say that most people do not fully see and understand this great truth, that life is difficult. And until you and I come to terms with the fact that suffering, not comfort and ease, is a normal human condition, we'll be made miserable by every untoward event. George Bernard Shaw understood this when he had one of his characters in a play state, "Oh, don't talk to me about comfort. Comfort makes winter a torture, spring an illness, summer an obsession, and autumn only a respite." He must have lived in Minnesota. What makes life so difficult is that the problems we face and try to solve involve a painful process. These problems variously frustrate us, anger us, or cause anguish, anxiety, regret, grief, and even despair. It moves us even to suicide. It moves others to grow stronger, to overcome adversity. One of these was Jeanette Picard, who I met in 1979 in Minnesota when I was due to give the Wesley Spink lectures. And she gave a talk there before my lectures in another setting. She talked on adversity. I was very impressed with this presentation and what she had to say. She was then 84 years old. When Jeanette was 2 years old, her identical twin was playing with matches and burned herself to death. Jeanette then became very attached to her next older sister, who died from a ruptured appendix when Jeanette was 5 years old. At the age of 11, Jeanette decided that she wanted to become a priest in the Episcopal Church and was qualified academically to enter the priesthood, or enter really the Episcopal Seminary at the age of 21, but she was denied admittance. She then went on to the University of Chicago, where she met and married another identical twin named Jean Picard. Her husband was offered a faculty position in Switzerland, but it didn't work out. So they returned to the United States in a faculty position at MIT. But business was booming then. It was the late 20s. So Jean Picard accepted a position in industry just before the 1929 financial collapse and a severe depression. And of course, Jean Picard lost his job. So they were without income. Our country, however, at that time was becoming very interested in the stratosphere and in space generally. And John's brother, with whom he had worked to develop the bathyscope for deep sea ocean research, was contacted about exploring the stratosphere. Since he was fully committed, he suggested his brother Jean was available. And And so Jean and Jeanette did some pioneering exploration in Stratosphere. Had a great time with it. In her 70s, Jeanette, having gained admission to a seminary, graduated and became the first woman ordained in the Episcopal Church at the age of 79. Now, in my situation, I readily admit that I live with a sense of imminent catastrophe. Ever since our daughter died in Cameroon, when any member of the family is due to arrive home, I'm uneasy until they arrive. I'm nervous when the telephone rings, especially early in the morning, late at night. I become even more aware of the uncertainties of life. And on many occasions in my life, I have been moved to ask God, why don't you listen to me? Why do you permit these terrible things to happen? I call God and there seems to be no answer. No one picks up the phone. I don't even get an intercept or a busy signal. On a few occasions, I've even been moved with the psalmist to ask, oh God, why hast thou forsaken me? And then I realize someone else, someone very special, said that under the very worst of circumstances, from a cross. Because of his death and resurrection, I can sit here before you tonight and justify adversity and offer you hope and strength. In my own case, I have learned much from adversity. Had I not been a prisoner of war, I would not be involved internationally in a Pets for Prison program. Neither would I have become involved in Amnesty International, helping prisoners of conscience throughout the world and trying to expose the torture carried out in so many countries, almost too many to name. Had I not been starved for an extended period of time, I probably would not be so concerned about hunger in the world, nor involved in Bread for the World. Had my wife not lost her hearing, I wouldn't understand how terrible this handicap is, an attempt to help people so afflicted. And since losing a daughter, I've been far more effective in helping those who grieve with great loss, to listen to them as they articulate their grief. In introducing this subject, I recalled for you the terrible things that happened to Job, chosen people, and the Apostle Paul. Hear their response to the terrible sufferings. First, I'll recall three declarations from Job. The Lord gave, the Lord taketh away, blessed be the name of the Lord. That's pretty hard to swallow sometimes. Though he slay me, I will trust him. Or the third one, for I know that my Redeemer lives and at last will stand upon the earth. In Babylon, where Isaiah was ministering to the Israelites in exile, he not only recognized the terrible conditions and the great despair when he said, even the youth shall faint and be weary, and the young men shall fall exhausted. But he also said, they who wait for the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings like eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint. And Paul had a lot to say. In chains, facing the king who had the power of life and death over him, he said, I wish to God that not only you, but all those who are listening to me today might become what I am apart from these chains. And he also said, none of these other things move me, neither count I my life dear unto myself, so that I may finish my course with joy and the ministry which I have received of the Lord Jesus. Nearing the end of his most difficult and trying life, his convictions remained unshaken. You see, Paul had real convictions about his assignment here on earth. He wrote the Corinthians, seeing then that we have been entrusted with this great commission, which we owe entirely to God's mercy, we never lose heart. We never lose heart. It would be a great thing never to lose heart. But we so often do when we are overwhelmed by the shadows of adversity, the shadow of great sorrow, the shadow of death, or the shadow of nameless shame. How one reacts to adversity is the true test. Will it send us to the depths of despair or lift us to new heights of effective service? I am here to remind you that history confirms that people are most dynamic and creative when struggling against great odds, which characterized the Apostle Paul. To say we never lose heart is quite a statement. Dr. Ernest Campbell reminds us that Paul found his assignment under very strange circumstances on the Damascus Road. God met Paul on this road with a vision of Christ who suffered the worst of anyone in history and turned Paul directly around on another ministry, reminding Paul that the whole business was no longer in Paul's hands, but in God's hands. God was now calling the shots, and Paul would never be the same again and would never be safe from all manner of hazards again. He went through terrible ordeals, but he had a new place in the world, and now he knew who he really was. The center of life went from himself to God as he encountered him in Christ. He was now a new man who would never lose heart again. And that's why he could write confidently to his Christian friends in Corinth, seeing then that we have been entrusted with this commission, this great commission. We never lose heart. Now, the remarkable and wonderful thing about all of this is that this experience of Paul is also possible for the likes of you and me. We too have been entrusted with an assignment, a task, a mission, a ministry. God has commissioned each one of us for particular tasks in this world. We are to bloom wherever we are planted, which is a sign my wife has on her refrigerator door. Answering this assignment with God's help, we'll never lose heart. Hard pressed on every side, we are never hemmed in. Bewildered, we are never at our wit's end. Hunted, we are never abandoned to our fate. Struck down, we are never left to die alone. Now, I opened with what a six-year-old said about Christy McAuliffe and her sudden death in the Challenger disaster, that she had to come back because she had a little six-year-old girl. When I heard that, I recalled a touching story about a missionary and a family in Korea. The male missionary had worked hard for many years when his wife became critically ill. He and his four-year-old son were in deep grief over this. But she assured them that even though she'd die, they'd get her back again. And not long after she died, the missionary's son became critically ill. And just before he died, he assured his father that he should not weep, for he'd get him back again. And at the funeral for this child, a Korean lady was crying. And a friend of hers asked her why she was crying. And she says, "Because our foreign missionary has lost his son." Oh, her friend said, "Don't cry for him, but for me and for you who have lost children who will never see them again." There's a unique thing, you see, about these foreigners. They get their children back. And now I want to share with you help share with you some experiences of others. In April of 1980, I received this card. It's a picture of a cat on it. It's worn out now. And it says, "A friend is one who comes in when the whole world has gone out." It was a letter from somebody I had never met. "Dear sir," that's what people do for me sometimes when they don't know me. "I feel shy about writing you, but I would like to share something with you that I feel you will be interested in. I know you are involved in a program to furnish pets to shut-ins and all, hence this letter. My name is Hope. I'm in the doctoral program at Washington State. I'm on leave from my position as director of a special program with the California Rural Indian Health Board, Sacramento. My tribal affiliation is Kaw Nez Perce. And I was 19 years old and living in Borneo on the South China Sea. I was captured by the Japanese and placed in the prisoner of war camp at Kuching, Sarawak, Borneo, and later at Berhala, Borneo. I was there for 4 years. At the tribunal trials held in Singapore after the end of the war, Berhala was documented as being the most brutal barbaric POW camp of the Pacific Theater of War. Only a few of us survived. My young husband did not. She also lost a child. When my mother first saw me after I was released, she fell to the ground in a dead faint. My dad, a devout Christian, cursed heaven and hell. I know I looked terrible. The last time they'd seen me before the war, I was a beautiful 19-year-old girl. When I came back home after the war, I only weighed 70 pounds. My tongue had been cut. I could not form words plainly. My elbow was crooked from a bad break. My jaw had been broken and many of my teeth were gone. My eyes were filmed over from so many years of malnutrition. Two of my toes were missing and many of my feet bones were crushed. I could barely walk. I suffered from malaria, scurvy, beriberi, shigella, dysentery, impetigo to the nth degree. But as terrible as I looked, my emotional state was worse, and I feel very critical. Now that I am quasi-educated in behavioral sciences, I find it curious that no one, not even the military medical people, addressed themselves to my unseen problem. But I realized no one could know, and I was not telling. But all the brutal and the barbaric things that I'd seen, smelled, and heard, all the violence, all the torture and evilness, it was all very much in my mind and memory at that time. Do you know what I mean? And I know what she means to a very limited extent, because I still wake up in terror occasion. Although I was in a clean, airy, safe place, Letterman Hospital, my mind was still at the scene of all the blood and brutality and the beastliness of the place I had just left. My ultimate reaction to all this was to withdraw into myself and allow myself to trust or love or to be loved in return. I was full of fear and hate, but I had a loving, compassionate family. They were Quakers. And with their help, I crept back into stability and civility. It took about 12 years to come back. I was fortunate. Some of the people never could make the journey back. So the letter goes. And I hope we'll tell you some other things about it.
The reason I've consented to do this is because I trust Leo and I love Leo. And I know you're all Lutherans and you're all Christians. But the day I was captured, I was 8 months pregnant. And I was, the Japanese picked me up in a truck and a lot of other people and took us to a steamer on a river. And we lined up, but every time it was my turn to get on the steamer, I was sent back. Way to an end of a line that went way, way, way back. It almost seemed like as far as to Lucerne, because it took me a long time to walk there. And then the next day when I got for my turn again, I was turned back again. And so then I thought, I remembered a story I had read when I was 14 years old about the Arabs. How they used to capture pregnant women and cut them open and take out the baby and sew the woman back up and then use the woman for milk. And in my little mind, I thought about that. And I thought, before that happens, I'll kill myself. So the next time I came up to the steamer and they were going to turn me back, there was a lot of fruit and garbage in the water, and it was full of oil, and I didn't want to kill myself. I didn't want to jump in there, so I thought, well, I'll just wait, and then I'll fight to the death, or I'll choke myself to death. And so this time, somebody told me, you're to stay with the nuns. And the commandant, when he saw I was pregnant, had made an order in writing that I was to stay with the nuns. And so I went back to where the nuns were. And then we were taken to a place that wasn't finished, but it was just a place. And so because I was pregnant, and I knew I was going to have a cesarean, I kept asking everybody, where was I going to have the baby? And one of the nuns kept saying, I wish somebody had shut that bloody fool up. And I was thinking, I always thought nuns were married to Jesus, and that they wore a ring, and that they would be Christ-like, and that they would help me, and that I'd be safe with the nuns. Also, I discovered that the commandant was a graduate of the University of Washington and was a Catholic. But one day, I was captured on Christmas Day, 1941. But on January the 10th, I was stirring rice in a big oil drum, and a bubble formed and burst, and it burned me very badly. So the nuns ran to get the commandant, but he sent two guards and the medic. And so I was very scared because I was starting contractions. And so I asked the nuns if they'd go with me, and they said they couldn't unless they were requested. And so then I went to the Mother Superior, almost running like a crazy person, because these were missionary nuns. And they spoke the language. And I begged her to go with me. And I remember how white her face was, as white as her habit. And she was a rather fragile older woman. She said, I can't. So I got on my knees and begged her. And then she wouldn't do it, so I started digging a hole to hide in. But the guards and the medic, I didn't know he was a medic, because I thought they were going to take me and kill me. So they took me to a place that had palm fronds. It was like a carport. It didn't have any sides, and it had some lanterns that hissed like, and some sawhorses, and kind of like a bed. And I saw, out of the corner of my eye, I saw a book, big square, the pages were big square, with anatomy in Japanese. Anyhow, they gave me ether, they tied me down with some towels, and almost choked me to death because I started vomiting. And he performed a cesarean of sorts. And then because he came and talked to me later with an interpreter, and he told me that he thought I was going to not have any milk and I was going to see the baby die. And so he put a hot steaming towel over the baby's face. And the nuns buried her. And so then it took me a long time to get well. And then one day, they told us that our husbands were going to come to see us, because I didn't know where my husband was. But when everybody got, we weren't allowed to touch. We were quite about from here to there apart. And I kept running up and down, looking for my husband, and he was never there. And so then I went to the commandant and asked him where my husband was. And he said he didn't know, and that I shouldn't be bothering him. And he was mad at me. And so the monsoons had started. And finally, everybody was gone. Everybody was crying. I had made my husband a little handkerchief and embroidered his name, Ted. And then when everybody was gone, I threw myself down on the ground. And I sobbed and sobbed and sobbed. And I remember that moment as though it were yesterday, because that's the time I changed. I knew that everything my parents had taught me wasn't true. That I was alone thinking that there was no one to look after me. And that love and tenderness and softness and honor and trust were going to be gone out of me. And I was going to be cunning and clever. I don't think I meant to be mean, but I was going to be different. I was going to be cold. And so I tried to make that metamorphosis happen to me. Metamorphosis. And so several days later, when I was at my hammock, from my hammock, I could see the nun's altar. They had built a thatched little hut around their altar. And so I deliberately got up and went over to their altar and just tore it to pieces. Tore up all the candles, all the crucifixes, all the crocheted things. I tore everything. I had great strength. Their altar was up on some sawhorses, some kind of water. I tipped it over. I took the sawhorses and beat it. And then I just casually went back and laid down in my hammock again. And so I knew I was going to get it. But I didn't care. I really didn't care. And so I had to go to the commandant's office. And he told me, he said, I'm getting tired of your delinquent ways. And he said, I've put up a lot with you because you've had a tragedy. And he said, I'm losing face with everybody. And he said, I've been good to you, made allowances for you because you're Indian. But he said, I'm going to send you away now. I'm going to send you to a punishment camp. And he said, I want you to be ready to go in the morning on the steamer. And so I didn't care. I was ready in the morning, and he sent 30 of the nuns who were poor Claire and wouldn't work. And so he wanted to get rid of them too, so he sent them along. And he said, you're to live with the nuns. And he put it in writing. And so we got on the steamer, and we were to go, I don't know how many hundred miles away it is to the Sea of Sea, but it was, you know, about 6 days, I guess. But the captain on the steamer was a gross-looking man who used to wear his kimono and not pull it too in the front. And I saw him eyeing me. And so when I saw him eyeing me, I just threw up all over myself so that I'd be undesirable to him. And then I just stayed right in the middle of the nuns. And every time he looked at me, every time, I would just throw up. And then if I thought and looked at me a long time, I just act like I was really sick, had some terrible disease. So we got to this other camp, which had been an old depot. And it wasn't anything like the other camp. It was a very primitive place. It's where they brought in people who had lived in the outback and guerrillas and people that they were having problems with. And they had the Australian military and the British military. And they had the civilian British and the priest, and then we women, and we had 30 children. And I used to cry for my mother a lot. But when I got there, I didn't cry anymore. And so along about, well, they reduced our rations to 3 ounces of rice a day and tea. So whatever, so we had eaten everything, the bark, the leaves, the grass. If it didn't numb your lips, we ate it. And we kept dying badly. There were only 5 Americans, and I had buried 4. Then we had an earthquake, and from where I was lying in my hammock, I could see the earthquake hit, kind of uprooted a palm tree between the barbed wire and the seawall. And so I thought maybe I could, between there was a grassy knoll. We had gotten all the grass in that we could reach. But after I wanted to go out there, all I wanted to do was lie down out there in that. I wanted to lie where it was cool and grassy and pretty. And so I found a way to unbraid the barbed wire, and I got out there. And I didn't think anybody could see me, but a nun saw me. And she told me to come back, and I wouldn't do it. So she went and told the commandant that I was out there. And so they came and got me. And then I was given a whipping that bursted my eardrum and broke my jaw. And I was beaten very badly to where I didn't recuperate for a long time. And so because of that experience, though, the mothers in camp, because we were dying and the children were dying, the mothers in camp, I was in my hammock. I wasn't hardly able to walk yet. And they came and asked if they could talk to me. They said, since you know how to get out, because we were on an island which had a leper colony about, the island was about 4 miles around, but up through the forest we could see smoke. And we had gotten word, we had heard, somebody had heard from the Australians that there was a leper colony there, and that they had peanuts and chickens and pigs and goats and vegetables. And so they asked if I would try to swim the lagoon and get across, that there was a path that the natives had made, and get up to the leper colony and bring back some food. That if I would do that, that they would save their food that they had and try to feed me so I have more strength. And so I told them no, I wouldn't do it. But as time went by, I couldn't bear to see the little children. So it took a long time, and I'm talking about 6 months, and we had a trial, we had a rehearsal. And when I got outside the seawall, I got scared and I came right straight back with everybody cursing me. But I was so scared. But I finally did go. And when I got to the leper colony, one of the lepers had stepped out from where he lived to relieve himself, and he saw me there, and I was scared of him and he was scared of me. And so, but he went and got the doctor, who was Dr. McElwain, he was Scottish. This was a Belgian leper colony. And so he was really angry when he saw me, because he said, do you know we have some Japanese guards here who have tuberculosis? And he said, you're putting us all in jeopardy by your selfishness and things like that. And also he said that lagoon that I had just swum was full of the bloody flux, and I didn't know what that was. And he said also there were poisonous toads in that marsh around there. And so, but he did wrap some things in some waterproof paper, and then he tended to a lot of my sores. And I had 4 impacted wisdom teeth, and he tried to help my teeth. I was suffering from that. And so I had to get back before light. And so anyhow, I got back. But I was so scared that it was almost like I was somebody else. I was so scared. I was sure those poisonous toads were everywhere I stepped. He told me that bloody flux would get in your vagina and get in your bloodstream. And, anyhow, so I got back in, and we tried to make everything look okay again. And so, I don't know how many times I went, but I was awarded the Medal for Freedom, and it said 13 times, but I honestly don't remember. Then another time we had an air raid and I was in a cage being punished. And somebody said, "You forgot Lala," that was my name. And so they ran to let me out, and it seems that the guards had gotten their ration of sake that day, but I didn't know what sake. I don't know very much about liquor because my folks were Quakers. But I grabbed these earthen things and I took all that rice I could get and I just plastered my body with it everywhere. So that when I jumped in, you know, the trench, then I started passing out all this rice and I was carrying all these, they were earthen little things. So then when the air raid was over and I went back to the cage, the guards were really angry, really mad about who had stolen all that. And so then I threw up, and then they knew who had stolen all that. And so then they said they were going to kill me. Me and 8 others. So they put me in a warehouse, and through the slats, everybody was crying and praying. And I was really angry at God. I didn't believe in God anymore. I hated God. And but I looked through that slat and miraculously there was a moon. And it was just beautiful. And I was looking at that moon and I thought, that moon used to be over Pasadena, California. So I said, "Well, God, if you're there, God, because I don't hardly believe in you anymore, but if you are there, if you'll save my life, I promise you that I'll live the rest of my life in the service of others, doing good deeds, and be the very best Christian I can be, and that I will rear my children to be the same way." And so in the morning they came and they let us go. They didn't shoot us after all. And I thought about that promise I had made. And so I kept that promise. It wasn't easy though because I didn't really want to do it. I wanted to backslide lots of times. I have a terrible temper. But I have lived my life in the service of others. I secured the very best education I could secure so that I would have the knowledge to help others. And I have always tried to help those less able to help themselves. And I am currently working with the homeless, abused women and children, American Indian seniors, and American Indian training program. And that's not what I would have chosen for myself to do, except that I made that promise to God, and I have to do that. But then I want to tell you one more thing. When I was in graduate school, both my parents died almost at the same time. And now that I'm better educated, I realize that was my support group. And that when they died, then it was a disaster. I was absolutely, totally alone. And so I decided to kill myself. But I was going to do it in such a way that no one would know and that it wouldn't hurt anyone else. And so I was thinking about how to do it and I was giving things away. And I hadn't given away my typewriter yet. But I was like where I lived. I was lying on a beach towel outside and I was just thinking, how can I best do this so I don't hurt anyone? You know, or bring shame on anyone. And over in the bushes, I saw a movement. And there was a little gray cat. And so I was a very poor student because I got all my education in the Bureau of Indian Affairs and they don't give you any luxuries at all. And so I took that cat and I only had some cheese that maybe it would like. And I kept that cat. And so of course I could not kill myself because I had made a commitment to that cat. And so I ask God's forgiveness because I know your body's your temple. And I haven't thought about that anymore. And I named that cat Lala, which is my name in prison camp. And now I have quite a few cats. I sleep with a cat.
She's looking for one to sleep with here.
That's the truth.
Lala means
precious.
Precious. Now, and
well, let's do adversity too sometime, right?
Should we?
Yes.
You'd rather not give him a little turkey bar?
No, another time.
All right.
Okay.
I'll give you the last paragraph, and then those of you who wish to leave me and those who wish to remain to ask us questions or tell you your experiences, we'd be pleased to hear them. This is my closing paragraph. In our abbreviated assignment here on planet Earth, you and I are not called to an easier task, but a greater cause. We are called not to peace, but to battle. We are directed not to some snug harbor, but to some storm-tossed sea, with God's help we'll not lose heart, as we recall Paul's words to the Romans. I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared to the glory that will be revealed to us. And his words to Timothy, I have fought a good fight, I have finished my course, I have kept the faith. We have our great God who said, let light shine out of darkness. And this great God has shown in our hearts to give the light of knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Christ. My hope and prayer for all of you here tonight is that you will keep the faith and never lose heart.